Blog Talk Radio.
There's a better world that's coming, tell you why. There's a better world that's coming, tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world that's coming, tell you why. There's a better world that's coming, don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world that's coming, don't you see?
Good evening, my friends. Happiest of holidays to you all, one and all alike. And as I heard an actor say in Abraham Lincoln Mask today, with malice toward none and charity for all, I want to remind all you good progressives out there that as the Tea Party and the Republican Party shreds itself to death, let us be generous, my friends. We are of the future and they are of the past, and be gentle. Be gentle with them. This news just in. We've got a great show for you tonight. PNN Goes Green with Dr. Bob Bowman, Space Coast Progressive Alliance, who's going to talk to us about a global picture of green and a global picture of a better world. He used to be the Star Wars director for Presidents Carter and Ford. He has an interesting global perspective for us. Then we've got Rebecca Marquez of Oceana, Matthew Swartz of Florida Wildlands, Drew Martin of the Palm Beach Soil and Water Conservation Board, and Phil Compton of the Sierra Club with a state perspective. So, got some great guests tonight. And first, of course, the news. Our good friends, the activists down in Lake Worth. Lighted sign revealed at Lake Worth Holiday Wonderland bears message for the lame duck congressman. West, don't be a tax cut Grinch. At Lake Worth's Holiday Wonderland, the crowd chuckled and clapped as local constituents revealed a lighted holiday message for their lame duck congressman. West, don't be a tax cut Grinch. The activists with the group Stand Up Florida emphasized that extending the middle class tax cuts, averaging $2,200 per family, is a holiday assurance people need that they can make ends meet in the new year. Activists said that the election of President Obama and the defeat of Alan West was a clear mandate of the economic policy people want locally and nationally. The president has called for extending middle-class tax cuts and increasing taxes on the very wealthy, and the constituents are calling on West to vote the will of the people as the fiscal, so-called fiscal cliff negotiations continue in the lame duck Congress. Only Congress, my friends, would put a gun to its own head and then worry about the threat. On a much more somber note, a 14-year-old Afghan girl was beheaded and killed in an attack by two men, one of whom was disappointed that she had refused to marry him. It seems that all those years of fighting, whether we're in favor of the Taliban, against the Taliban, in favor of the Taliban, against the Taliban, negotiating with the Taliban, very little has changed for women's rights in that terrible land. The attack happened Tuesday, the day before the new legislation was introduced in our Congress, calling on the U.S. government to take steps to help protect Afghan women and girls as the U.S. military prepares to exit Afghanistan. Gastina, a student, was beheaded in the Imam Sahib district of Kundar province. The attack was initially reported by local media and was confirmed by Amnesty International researcher Oria Mosarik in an email. The girl was fetching water when she was accosted, according to reports. The men who have not been identified were arrested by police. The girl and her parents had refused a marriage proposal by one of the men, and therefore, of course, by the logic. Okay, on a more positive note, our friends down in Palm Beach will be presenting a presentation on the new Jim Crow. That'll be Tuesday, December 4th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Palm Beach. And that's 635 Prosperity Farm Road, North Palm Beach, 33408. Just get in touch with the Unitarian Universalist Congregation and you can get some more information. By the way, if you have a news announcement you'd like us to make, please send it to news at newmercurymedia.com. That's news, N-E-W-S, news at newmercurymedia.com. Occupy Fort Lauderdale's labor outreach group will be meeting at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Fort Lauderdale. That's 3970 Northwest 21st Avenue in Oakland Park. They're going to be talking about the Dr. King event, so mark your calendars. That'll be Sunday, January 13th at the UUCFL. What would Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. do, and what will you do in 2013? They'll be commemorating Dr. King's commitment Sunday, January 13th of 2013 at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Fort Lauderdale, 3970 Northwest 21st Avenue, Oakland Park. There'll be an 11 a.m. Sunday service. The sermon will be Dr. King on Peace, Internationalism, and Militarism. Judith LeBlanc of Peace Action, the nation's largest grassroots peace group, will be there. Okay. Also coming up, the New York Times has an interesting article sent by my good friend Tufik. New York Times has a long study on subsidies for profitable corporations. You know, they talk about entitlements. What about the entitlements, many of us ask? What about the entitlements to corporations? One of the things the New York Times highlighted is that companies take these tax benefits and these grants, and instead of spending them locally, they spend them internationally. And the focus on Florida, Tufik sent me, says that Florida spends at least $3.98 billion of your tax dollars per year on incentive programs, entitlements for corporations. According to the most recent data available, that's roughly $212 per capita, or 16 cents of every dollar. 16 cents of every state budget dollar. And the top incentives by type, $3.66 billion in sales tax refunds, exemptions, or other sales tax. $108 million in cash grants, loans or loan guarantees. $102 million in corporate income tax credits, rebates or reductions. And the top incentives by industry, $142 million in agricultural, $83.9 million in film, and $43 million in manufacturing. But let us not forget that these are, by the way, check out the New York Times for more data on that. This is the environmental show, so we wanted to remind you that there was just a huge land collapse, a sinkhole in Ohio, in just a few minutes took over 4 football fields of land. The large sinkhole in Louisiana, the authorities are now saying there's a huge accumulation of gas, and they think that could be very dangerous. There's Homeland Security's there on site. And also news from Fukushima. It seems that there's some interesting information available there. BBC reports that the fish are still contaminated off the coast of east coast of Japan, in a sign that Daiichi power plant continues to be a source of pollution more than a year after the accident. 40% of fish caught close to Fukushima are regarded as unfit for humans under Japanese regulations. The respected U.S. marine chemist Ken Boozler has reviewed the data in this week's Science Journal, another source of good information. I'll be putting up the links on the AveryVoice.com site, so take a look at that. He says there's probably 2 lingering sources of contamination. There's the ongoing leakage into the ocean of polluted groundwater from under Fukushima, and then there's, of course, the contamination that's already in the sediments just offshore. With these results, it's hard to predict how long some fisheries may have to be closed. All points to the issue being long-term, and it'll need to be monitored for decades. Professor Boozler is affiliated with the U.S. Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. His evaluation covers a year's worth of data gathered by the Japanese Ministry of Agriculture, Forestry, and Fisheries. It's a monthly records detailing the levels of radioactive cesium found in fish and other seafood products from shortly after March 2011 the Tohoku earthquake and tsunami, the double disasters that triggered the Fukushima crisis. The cesium-134 and 137 isotopes can be directly traced to releases from the crippled power station. MAFF uses the information to determine whether certain fisheries along the 5 East Coast prefectures, including Fukushima, should be open or closed. It's not a measure of contamination in the actual fish market. And there's some other very powerful stories in the ENE News, which I urge you to check out. And two interesting drone stories. Drones have been crashing in increasing levels at civilian airports. And I have to definitely tell you at the same time that the Department of Homeland Security is going to double U.S. drone traffic. So keep those two things in mind. No place like drone. No place like drone. Without any further ado, I want to bring on my first guest. This will be Dr. Bob Bowman, one of the founders of the Space Coast Progressive Alliance. And here we go with Dr. Bowman.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Richard Spisak, news director of Progressive News Network. We're going to call Dr. Bob Bowman, former director of the Star Wars program under Presidents Ford and Nixon, and also under Reagan.
Hello.
Good morning, Dr. Bowman.
Yes.
Dr. Bowman, Rick Spisak, Progressive News Network. How are you doing today, sir?
Okay.
Sir, you are a man of so many interesting pursuits. I was wondering if I could ask you, for our audience's sake, to just give us a little thumbnail sketch about the work that you've done in the past, your military career, your work on the Star Wars program, and then your I guess, disenchantment with where it was going. Sir, if you go ahead and introduce yourself.
Okay. Lieutenant Colonel Robert M. Bowman, U.S. Air Force, retired. Spent 22 years in the Air Force. Flew 101 combat missions in Vietnam. Directed all of the Star Wars programs under Presidents Ford and Carter when their existence was secret. And when I retired, felt pretty good about what we had been doing, including with the Star Wars program. Our objective was to develop technology, system studies, see if the whole thing was feasible. We're also developing mirrors for the lasers and laser itself, BRW, and tracking systems and whatnot. But there had been no decision to deploy a system, which would be in violation of the M Treaty. After I retired, the people behind Ronald Reagan convinced him that this was a great thing to employ as a peace shield. But in reality, they were changing the nature of the system to make it a pure offensive weapon, and started speaking out within limits of what I could do because of secrecy. And once Reagan was elected, secrecy started going away because they were attempting to sell this stuff to the public. And so I started speaking out more forcefully and seeing members of Congress and the rest of it, and wound up debating the people in the new SDI program. This led to number of things, including being forced to retire from industry, and as a consequence, formed a small nonprofit organization to support work, spreading the truth. And eventually, this became the Institute for Space and Security Studies, and now the Patriots. And we're in the business of truth telling, countering government falsehoods from Star Wars to 9/11, you name it.
Well, that certainly is an interesting arc, sir. Obviously, your work in high technologies prepared you to have a very acute understanding of the issues involved in everything from, I guess, high-tech space war to a very keen analysis of how science is done and how, should we say, information gets twisted. We'll just say twisted in a variety of different government initiatives. First, let's talk about Star Wars before we get into 9/11. That's a whole other interesting set of complex issues. You mentioned that the Reagan administration and its supporters wanted to take the SDI Star Wars initiative and go to places where the treaties did not cover. Obviously, they were not very attentive to treaty guidelines. Do you see that whole campaign continuing? Obviously, we don't hear much more about Star Wars, but is that a stealth technology? Is that just in implemented, but we just don't hear about it?
Most of what we were talking about is not implemented. They did do enough to destroy the ABM treaty, and know that there are things going on in the black. Star Wars was entirely a black program. I directed it. There are, however, a lot of things that get blamed on secret space weapons programs that I think wrong. It doesn't deserve the blame.
Now, there was some talk maybe a year or so ago about a Chinese satellite supposedly possibly doing some damage to, I think it was an American satellite. Do you have any sense of that, or was that off your radar?
Well, Chinese have been active in anti-satellite work and have taken out some of their own satellites, as we did early on. I don't see any indication that the Chinese are involved in the kind of Star Wars program that visioned $1 trillion for...
Let me ask you the question, sir. I understand that you've got a perspective on the... what is called the 9/11, well, let's just call it the 9/11 incident. We won't characterize it any further than that, sir. Obviously, as a man of great technical depth, you have some insight. What are your thoughts about either the whole thing in general or obviously that mysterious building that collapsed in sympathy with the others?
Well, what we know for sure is that the government story is impossible. And so the government story about how they evaded our air defenses, how they struck the buildings and caused failures, which then caused the collapse of the buildings and so forth, we know that's a bunch of malarkey and is physically impossible. But we don't know for sure exactly who the perpetrators were, exactly how they did it. Now, based on the evidence, we have some supposition guesses, which would be pretty good. My guess is that whatever struck the Twin Towers were under radio control, that the cockpit controls and communications from the aircraft had been completely shut off, and the planes were being flown by somebody else on the ground. That would explain some stuff with regard to the Pentagon. As for who the players were, a lot of suspects, most of them dual citizenship, U.S.-Israeli. And, of course, Dick Cheney appeared to be very much involved in the stand down and the cover up. There are a lot of people who just say, oh, the Mossad did it, it was Israel. I think that's simplistic. I think neocons involved, and the neocons is not a national organization. It's a group of people who want war, and most of them are dual citizenship, U.S.-Israeli.
You know, most people who've thought about it, and obviously many people don't, but people who think about it often ask the question, cui bono, who benefits? And if you were to address that, who would you say benefited from this, you know, officially designated terrorist event? Who benefited from that?
Well, who benefited from it are all the people who benefited from the subsequent wars in the War on Terror. And here again, Dick Cheney and his Halliburton earned billions of dollars from the war. And, of course, there were financial concerns with or in Afghanistan as well, with the gas pipeline through Afghanistan, which was the original reason for invading. That war plan was all set out before 9/11 happened.
Let me ask you another question, if I may, sir, and feel free to wave me off if it's not an area that you can really address. But I am by far the last person to be guessing at military strategy, but it would seem to me that even as unlikely as it is, there must be some tremendous plans in the Pentagon to protect the Pentagon itself from physical attack. Do you find it very odd, I know I do, that the Pentagon would be so easily attacked if that's what it was?
Absolutely. To think that the best protected building in the world was so easily struck and severely damaged by an unarmed airliner boggles the mind. It's just one little thing that is not believable about the government story.
I mean, the coincidence of the exercise that had everyone stand down, the coincidence of them not being able to track an errant airliner or many errant airliners over the most prestigious city in the world. I mean, it just strains credulity to even imagine it.
Yes, absolutely.
I've seen some mention in some of your material about the curiosity of the building that fell without being struck. Do you have any insight into that, sir?
Well, sure. Building 7, World Trade Center, not struck an aircraft. It was hit by some pieces of debris from the towers, but thing that building was in danger of collapse. See the video of Building 7 coming down. It looks for all the world like a controlled demolition of an intact building with no visible fires.
And since most controlled demolition is done by a very carefully engineered team of demolition experts so that a building can be safely dropped on its own footprint, it seems to me to stagger the imagination that a building, let's just take it as read, a building struck by an airplane, if that's what it was, should accidentally fall exactly on its own footprint. I mean, this again, you know, it doesn't face the simple truth fact.
Right, and of course that applies to the Towers 1 and 2. In case of Building 7, which wasn't struck by an aircraft at all, then other factors come into play, but building coming down the way it did, still, I don't see any explanation other than a controlled demolition.
Let me ask you another question. Again, this is slightly off topic from the normal arena, but you're such an incredible resource, sir. Obviously, you retired at the, I guess, rather at the beginning of the Reagan administration. You must have looked at the whole Iran-Contra investigation sort of askance, the military sort of what all you North called a standalone off-the-shelf foreign policy. It seems that they've got that now with all the mercenary companies.
Yeah, I'm appalled at how much of our military policy and our foreign adventures have been privatized, and we have high-priced mercenaries doing a job that the U.S. Marines used to do.
Now, you were instrumental, as I understand it, in the founding of the Space Coast Progressive Alliance and the peace work that that great organization does. Can you talk a little bit about that that organization and your part in that?
The Coast Progressive Alliance is an alliance of organizations, peace and justice and environment and all the good issues. I was just one of many people involved in bringing it together, and it's still doing great work.
One other area I was wondering if I could get you to talk a little bit about, and I really appreciate your very generous use of time here. You've obviously been involved in both the nation's security as well as raising questions about the all too casual way too many people think of nuclear weapons. If you were to sort of sum up what you've learned through your career and through both your work for security and your work for peace, what would you say, sir, is important for people to understand?
Well, I think the big thing is that in retrospect, my work for peace at the world has been a lot more important on run of history than my military service, combat missions and all the rest of that. About what persevere is important to this country and its people and to posterity.
Many of us have taken the lesson of the Marine General
Medley Butler.
Yes, sir. His lesson about war being a racket. We've taken it very much to heart, sir. Would you say that's an accurate description of what had happened in Iraq and Afghanistan, sir?
Government went in to those countries for financial reasons, not necessarily to enrich our country's coffers, but to enrich big money people, direct the course of our government. In the case of Afghanistan, actually, our gas pipeline, which had agreed to and back from. And we not only went in there and kicked out Taliban rulers who had refused, came to Bush's ranch in Texas. It sort of agreed to pipeline. They went home and then they said, no, we've changed our minds, the pipeline. And we went in there and got rid of them and installed as the new president executive with Unocal, that wanted to build the pipeline.
He was a little more flexible.
Yes. Then our ambassador was also a Unocal employee. Turns out that it's not only the pipeline, but the opium. The Taliban had essentially shut down the opium trade and destroyed most of the poppy crop. Well, it's back. We're element allied with our government are profiting from it.
Do you see the growing African command and the saber rattling in Africa as part of that same natural resource grab that has guided so much of our foreign policy?
Yeah, sure. Anything like that, the resource grab are always a big part of it. Smedley Butler said that. I say it. There are a lot of people who say it. Still going on. I read Smedley Butler's little book, War is a Racket, maybe once a year to remind myself of how far back this goes.
I had the misfortune to be talking with a history professor in a nearby college, and I mentioned the Banana Republics in a historical reference, right? The guy goes, what do you mean? What's it have to do with clothing? He absolutely had not heard the term in its political sense. He was unaware of those resource wars that was so important in guiding our friends in Central and South America.
Well, I hope that we learn the lessons from the past. I hope that this election we keep the neocons out, who seem to be very much in control of these policy, and is that President Obama continued many of the policies of George W. Bush, started by neocons, Cheney and Earl, and we've got to make sure that their influence does not creep in, sure that they are not able to sell the next administration, whoever it is, on new wars in Iran, Syria.
Well, thank you again, Dr. Bowman. I really appreciate you joining us. I'd love to have you back again. We'll talk in the future, sir. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Have a good day, sir. That was Dr. Bob Bowman. And now I'd like to welcome Ms. Rebecca Marquez from Oceana. Rebecca, welcome.
Hey, Rick. Thank you for having me on today.
How are you tonight?
I'm feeling great. How about you?
Very good, very good. So tell us, what do we need to know about what's going on in our oceans?
Well, great. Well, as I'm sure you know, Rick, there has been, it's been quite a month in November. There's been, I would say, around three major things that have happened in the past month. There was first, you know, the terrible oil rig explosion that left three dead, which I'm sure you heard about that right off our Gulf.
Oh, sure, sure.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, and the next two, you know, of course, dealing with BP. So we had the BP oil spill settlement and also the announcement of BP being banned from competing for all new contracts in the United States. So while
I heard some qualifiers later, but yeah, please go on.
Oh, yes. So, yeah, as you can imagine, which I'm sure you gathered from this, it's kind of semi-good news. And I know that's seems like an odd statement for it, but while, you know, the announcements were definitely not bad news, they were not nearly quite enough. So, for instance, yeah, exactly. And I think when anyone takes it out of context, you know, thinking about this, this was the worst environmental disaster known in history. So, you know, the BP oil settlement, while it's the biggest to date record, it's not nearly severe enough. So we're talking about 1/10 of the maximum possible sentence fine for the BP was imposed. So while $4 billion, you know, seems great for us nonprofit organizations and seems like a lot of money. Yeah, exactly. It seems like a lot of money for you and me, Rick, maybe. We have to remember that this is less than 3 months' worth of profits for these companies.
Yeah, my goodness.
Yeah, I mean, the money going into this industry is just really mind-boggling. I mean, it's mind-blowing how much money is in here. And to think that, you know, with how many people lost their lives with this disaster and how much damage is still being done to so many communities, and especially here in Florida, to think that after all of this, that this wasn't even a quarter of the profits that BP makes in a year. You know, less than 3 months worth. I mean, we should be furious, honestly. So, I mean, there's still hope that the civil case will be able to reach their maximum penalty, which would be around $50 billion. But as you know, we shouldn't hold our breath for too long on that. And another semi-good news is that BP was banned from competing for new contracts in the United States. And, you know, there are some good signs and signals that come from that. You know, it does send a clear message to other oil companies that, you know, this, you know, cannot be tolerated, that this will happen. We will not do business with irresponsible companies. But it's important for us to remember, for two big main reasons why we really absolutely should not be satisfied with this. Firstly, because BP is already claiming, I mean, it's already pretty much boasting that it's already filed paperwork to get back into good graces with the EPA. You know, and the ban did have an exception that says this ban will only be imposed until they reach new business standards that satisfy federal regulations. So the ban is absolutely conditional, you know, and it doesn't do anything to prevent, you know, the BP contracts that have already been in place with the United States government. So the second reason why we really need to watch out for this and not be completely satisfied with this is because it doesn't really solve the problem of the oil spill, which is offshore drilling. You know, at the end of the day, we talk about BP a lot. We talk about...
Sure.
Yeah. How, and there was complete negligence. But at the end of the day, you know, there's oil spills every single day. And while they might not be the Deepwater Horizon, there's always oil spills going on. And at the end of the day, what's dangerous and what caused the oil spill is offshore drilling. You know, offshore drilling is completely dirty, it's dangerous, and it's unnecessary. So the Deepwater Horizon spill could have been any of the other major oil companies, just as easy as it was BP. Yeah. So that's why we really need to use this opportunity to start getting serious about banning offshore drilling. And that will only happen, Rick, I'm convinced, is if we as citizens force it to happen.
Well, you know, we were fortunate when that senator from Massachusetts stood up and said, we demand live video feed of that. We're not going to take anything that you say at face value. You know, I've been terribly disappointed in our state senators and representatives to see them absolutely AWOL, when it came times to where were the public hearings? Where were the hearings from coast to coast asking for public input? You know, they're content to let it be with the lawyers. They're content to have that gentleman who's going to decide. Well, you know, yes, for everybody who has all their paperwork in order, I'm sure there was some reasonable accommodations made. But we know in a world where fishermen go out and catch fish, there's not a lot of paperwork. They don't get a receipt from the ocean bottom. And when clearly lie after lie after lie was caught and exposed, we're going to take them at their word? Are you kidding me?
Absolutely. And, I mean, it's something that's time and time proven us. And that's what is just as crazy when you start thinking about it, is that if you take it, you know, back a step, we're in the exact same position before the oil spill in 2010 and right afterwards as we are now. You know, we have not made any substantial step towards regulation to stopping offshore drilling. I mean, considering especially we're only now entering talks and possibility to start seismic air gun testing on the Atlantic coast. You know, we're actually talking about expanding to the Atlantic coast. So that is where it really surprises me. And that's why people really need to get involved.
You know, when I heard things like, oh, well, don't worry, it all just disappeared. Are you kidding me? Wait, is this the virgin birth all over again? Voila. We send some Coast Guard out there, and now it's all mysteriously just disappeared. Except that it hasn't.
Yeah. And absolutely not. I mean, and it's not going to disappear for a really long time. And the scary part about that is, think about how long this is taking this to clean up, you know, in one particular area. Now think if we expanded offshore drilling, you know, to our Atlantic coast, you know, off of the coast from, they're talking about that they want to look for oil from Delaware to Florida. So think about if there was, you know, with how it goes of our coast, all the main cities, look at the big cities that we have there. Look at the local economies that were hurt, especially Florida. Imagine if we had an oil spill that came on our beaches on, you know, side where we have, you know, Miami Beach and South Beach and Fort Lauderdale and all these huge big communities with, you know, tourism that our economy thrives on. What are we going to do then, Rick? And how can we possibly clean that up when we're looking at the Gulf that's still being cleaned and nowhere near being, you know, done with the oil, you know, over 2 years later? It's just not feasible. And well, it's really scary that that's being put to the table.
And of course, you know, between the drill baby drill mentality, the mm-hmm. expansion of the this tar sands pipeline.
Yeah, definitely.
What a great gift to our environment that is. What kind of initiatives is Oceana working on to either increase public awareness or establish some public forums? Tell us, what's Oceana up to right now to help get people more aware?
Well, there's a couple of things we're working on. What I'm focused on right here in Florida, right now we are still raising awareness. We did take, you know, some time to definitely address the BP oil spill, and our national office has done a really great job at engaging media because this was, again, an opportunity because of the BP settlement, et cetera, to get back in the media talking about offshore drilling because, of course, you know, what it's not a pretty issue sometimes to sell newspapers. But what I'm working – and that's the sad truth.
You're
of
being very generous, my dear, to our friends in media.
But and it's not true. So our headquarters did a really great job of getting that, again, in national media. But what I'm working on, especially right here, and what we're working on nationally, is getting activists involved because there's a lot of ways that we can get people involved and we can make a difference. You know,
bravo.
Right now what I want to talk about is getting in contact with me. Anybody can get in contact with me at rmarquez, which is R-M-A-R-Q-U-E-S. At Oceana.org, or you can visit Oceana.org and sign up as a volunteer in our Wave Maker. We're actively going out in the community and collecting photo petitions. Right now, we're talking about seismic air guns, getting photo petitions about that. We've done demonstrations. We need people to write letters to editors. We need people to come with us to our representatives' offices and our local elected officials' offices and tell them not only are we against offshore drilling, but we want reasonable and clean energy to come here, and renewable energy to come to Florida, and really the whole United States, because this is what our future depends on, it, and our economy, honestly, also. So, you know, the Obama campaign did anything for activists, it really was legitimizing the power of back-to-basics, classic grassroots organizing. And there's no way we're going to ever beat these oil companies by playing their game. We can't win the money game. You see Moneyball. We can't beat the Yankees. We can't win that way, but we can win if we have everybody who's with us engaged. Because there are far more people, and I can say this from Rick being out in the field, talking to people every day. And I mean, I did the photo petitions against. Well, actually, it was just regular petitions against, you know, offshore drilling 2 years ago. But I can tell you, in this time, there has been a change of dialogue. And I can tell you right now, the people that are against offshore drilling feel so much more passionately against it than the people that are for offshore drilling. There's not that many people that are really for offshore drilling. There's people that might be misinformed and misdirected and don't quite know that we have renewable clean energy that we can use and we can harness right now. But no one is really for offshore drilling. And that's the thing. When we, if we could engage, and if someone could tell me, you know, in Jacksonville or Sarasota, I'd say, Rebecca, I'll organize, you know, a trip with six friends to go to a local elected official's office and tell them we don't want offshore drilling. If we can have letters to editors everywhere from, you know, one in Orlando and one in Miami, we can really make a difference. You know, I visited Senator Nelson's office in Miami the other day, and we're planning to do it again in Miami in January and hopefully again in Orlando around the same time, because we feel that, you know, one person saying, I'm going to talk to 10, 15 friends, and I'm going to get their photo petitions, and I'm going to be this much engaged, because not, you know, people have to work. People have lives. So not everyone, one person can't do everything, but there's something everybody can do. And I'm telling you, Rick, if you know, everybody that cared about the environment just did a little bit and became engaged and got off the sidelines like I did, because I was on the sidelines for a long time with the environment. Two things changed me, because I was, you know, I knew oil was bad. I think anybody could kind of see that. I believed climate change was real, but I really didn't become engaged in the whole environment cause. I didn't see it as my fight. And what changed that for me was the nuclear disaster in Japan.
Sure.
And then, yes, the BP oil spill here, because obviously that hit closer to home, figuratively and literally.
Sure.
So those two events, you know, told me, listen, like, that we need to get serious about this, and we need to get serious about it now, because this is something affecting Japan all the way to Tampa. This
yep.
is, you know, the whole world. This is what it's all about, and there's no time to waste in just doing what you can do now and getting engaged, you know, and talking to people that can set you up with the right people. And, you know, we can all make a difference no matter where we are. So, you know, it doesn't take a whole much to get involved, but the more people we can engage and ignite, the better time we're going to have in making at least our elected officials know that you're not going to be able to say that climate change isn't real and get elected. And that's something we have to change, because that's got to change.
I mean, we had an opposition party this last election. Not one of their candidates would even stand up for the scientific principle of evolution. There are some people who are, you know, Luddites. Really doesn't even give them half the credit. So clearly we have to speak to people who are listening, who are aware of the environment. Do you have plans to pull something together for Earth Day this spring, or are you working on smaller units for now, and you'll let that build up? Because I know the Hands Across the Sand events have been so successful.
Yeah. We're definitely going to be active with Hands Across the Sand. We think it's a really great event that we always want to be part of and always want to pull as much weight as possible. To that, you know, 2013, it's a big year for us. We think that there's a lot of good and definite changes that can be happening. We are going to be organizing we still have to figure out some of, you know, the fine-tuning of it.
Sure, logistical,
but, yeah, exactly. And I hope I can come back on here and talk about it further with you.
You count on it, dear.
Great. Well, and it's going to be, you know, themed Stand Up to Oil and Stand Up for Florida. And that's going to be our whole theme of it. And we're going to, right now, we're looking at a definite possibility of having it here in Miami, at FAU in Boca,
Super.
FIU also, yes, and UCF, and hoping to gauge some of the other big college universities to hold events there. And,
you know,
of course, Jacksonville.
Maybe one of the things our audience can do is to invite you to come out and speak to different groups. You know, one of the great things about the activist community is that so many of us are involved in so many different arenas. Maybe one of the things we can do, if when you start thinking about Rebecca and the work of Oceana, think of some place you can invite her to come out and speak, and maybe we can get a lot of groups involved, calling on Congress, calling on senators. So, Rebecca, why don't you give your email address again or your website so that they can reach out to you.
Well, thank you so much for that, Rick. I think, you know, I definitely believe that the more we can work together, I believe in coalitions. I believe in activists working with different groups coming together and volunteers always coming together. My email is rmarques@oceana.org. That's rmarques@oceana.org. And the website for Oceana is oceana.org. And there's a volunteer box that you can sign on, WaveMaker. And if you put your location, it'll set you up with mostly likely me if you're in the southern region, especially here in Florida. Also, we have a Facebook page or locally run one, which is Oceana Florida. If you just go into Facebook and type in Oceana Florida, you'll find that, and you can just message us, and I'll read those messages.
Well, super. That's awesome, my dear. You know, for many people who don't live a coastal life, you know, they may not love the ocean as those of us who live here and know the ocean personally. But, you know, when you've been in the ocean and you've seen that beautiful, you've had that beautiful experience and seen the sea life all around you, or if you snorkel or dive, you know what that living ocean is like. And all too many of us have had the experience where our oceans, our coastlines have been badly mistreated. The reefs off our coasts, too many of them have been so brutally treated. You know, your heart goes out. And I just hope that we get people calling you after this. My friends, reach out to Rebecca. Get her to come speak to your group, speak to your organization. We need to get people aware of this. We can't let them kill the oceans. We depend on the ocean. And I'm not just talking about seafood. We depend. The planet's respiration depends on the ocean. Thank you so much, Rebecca, for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
Is there any final message you want to give our listeners?
Just stay engaged because, you know, one person can make a difference joining with the right people.
Thanks so much, my dear.
Have a great day, Rick.
Okay, we have you back again soon. Just let us know when you got some more information for us, okay?
I will. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Okay, while we're waiting for our next guest, I'm going to read you another news item. It seems that progressives aren't the only ones who are against drone activity. A Pentagon official gets a restraining order, not so much against drones, but against anti-drone activists. A U.S. military commander has received a court order to keep a group of anti-drone activists at a distance and thereby suppressing criticism by preventing peace advocates from protesting in front of the military base where he works. I guess it was bringing him down. The Hancock Field Air National Guard Base, located in Syracuse, New York, has an area where nonviolent protesters can demonstrate on a weekly basis. And after anti-drone protesters repeatedly came to the base and vocalized their opinions on what they call President Obama's program of murder, a lieutenant colonel at the base received a court order banning 17 peace activists from coming anywhere near him, even though some of them don't even know who he is. The order came after the group protested in front of the entrance to the base in late October. 17 individuals who remained in place when the police told them to move were charged with trespassing and disorderly conduct and were banned from nearing Lieutenant Colonel Earl A. Evans. Gosh, it must have really ruined his day. Brought him down, so when he was steering those drones, he didn't have the normal smile on his face. Under that order, activists would be arrested and could face up to 7 years in prison if they demonstrate anywhere near Lieutenant Colonel Earl A. Evans. But it looks like we've got our next guest on there. Ladies and gentlemen, let me bring out... Is this the charming and talented Mr. Matthew Schwartz of Florida Wildlands?
It is indeed, Rick. How you doing?
Very good, sir. Very good. Welcome. Welcome to the Green PNN tonight. So tell us, what's new with Florida Wildlands, sir?
Well, I'm calling you from beautiful Estero, Florida right now.
Oh, what a beautiful
southwest
area.
It's a nice area. It's a nice area. It's a rapidly changing area. I came here to participate in a memorial service for a lovely woman named Ellen Peterson, who died.
Oh, yeah?
And this was her birthday. Yeah, Ellen was the former chair of the Calusa Group of the Sierra Club and did a lot of work with Florida Panthers and Fish Eating Creek and a lot of wildlands. And I was asked to come out here to do a talk on the Florida Panther, which I did, and then took today to basically drive around Southwest Florida and see what was happening. Are you able to hear me with the road noise in the background?
There's just moments ago, a little bit of breakup started happening. So if you could avoid that, that'd be great.
Okay, I'm just kind of on the road right now. I've got to get to a place where I can actually pull in. But, yeah, so right now my mind is very much on the Florida Panther. Southwest Florida is the home of the Panther, and or the remaining home, we should say. And there's a lot going on here, a lot of development. Little roads that were two-lane roads not too long ago, like Oil Well Road, is now a six-lane. And I just came from a place called the Picayune Strand State Forest. And it is rapidly becoming a new reservoir for Southwest Florida. They've got it all blocked off. They're building gigantic pump stations.
Matthew, let me ask you a question. I've got an interview tape I can play of Drew Martin. And that's about 15 minutes. Would you be in a better location in 15 minutes, you think?
You're getting a lot of background noise?
No, it's just that your own signal is breaking up quite a bit.
Okay, let me do this. Go ahead and put the tape of Drew on, and you want me to call back in?
That'd be good. Call back in 15.
Will do. Okay, Rick.
Okay, thanks
Bye-bye.
A lot. Bye-bye, Matthew.
Take care.
Okay, here we go. We've got Drew Martin and his report on the Palm Beach County Soil and Water Conservation Board. Here we go, Mr. Drew Martin.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Drew Martin, one of the members of the Palm Beach County Soil and Water Conservation District. Welcome, Drew.
It's very nice to be there. It's great to talk with you, Rick.
Drew, you always bring us so much excellent information on the issues at hand. I know we talked a little bit about two major issues right now facing us. Tell us about this controversy regarding mitigation.
Well, right now, what's happened is that when Governor Scott was elected, his argument was that he would create jobs if he could be allowed to destroy the environment. So he pitted the environment against jobs. Of course, if you go back and look at the history of Florida, environmental protection has really never hindered Florida's economic development. In fact, environmental protection is what brings people to Florida. It's why Florida is successful, because we have a good environment that attracts people to come here. But even though that's true, the other side is constantly complaining if they have to meet any kind of regulations. Well, there's two. One thing that happens a lot in Florida, because Florida is so significantly a wetland area, is that there's always been a lot of destruction of wetlands in Florida. And in modern times, of course, we realize now that destruction of wetlands is a bad thing. When you destroy wetlands, you destroy water quality, and you also increase flooding. So the state has what is called a mitigation program. And the idea of mitigation is, if you are going to destroy wetlands, you have to make sure that you have no net loss of wetlands, which means that you either have to restore wetlands somewhere else, or you have to establish protection of wetlands somewhere else to make up for whatever wetlands are being destroyed. Now, this has been, you know, never worked perfectly, but it was working better than it is now under Governor Scott, because under Governor Scott, they have hired a mitigation bank company, which is part of a huge conglomerate that some of us have heard of it, but it's a huge conglomerate from outside the state, which is trying to make profits off of these wetlands. And what they've picked are lands that are not truly wetlands, and to try to exchange those for lands that are. And this area means that we're going to lose wetlands. Well, right now there's a major project to destroy a significant number of wetlands, and the head of wetlands protection, a lady by the name of Bursak, I believe is how it's pronounced, was asked to evaluate this mitigation program, and she said that it wasn't going to work, that it wasn't going to provide the adequate number of points. And when she made that decision and came down and said that, she was suddenly threatened with being fired. And she was told to vacate her office, and she was put on disciplinary action. But it looks to everybody on the outside that she was basically being punished because she wouldn't go along with a mitigation plan that didn't work, that didn't meet the requirements of the law. Now, the state backpedaled, and she did not lose her job. She was kept on, but she was removed from this project. Her supervisor is a person by the name of Little John. He is the deputy secretary of DEP. He works directly for Mr. Vineyard, who is the secretary of Department of Environmental Protection for Florida. Mr. Little John took over the evaluation and declared the project to meet the standards. Now, what's interesting is she is an environmental scientist. He is not. And so she was making a truly, scientific evaluation, whereas he is making something based more on he's an engineer, so he's making more of an engineering evaluation. But the basic argument is that the land that they're using to mitigate this loss of wetlands is uplands and not wetlands, and so you cannot replace wetlands with something that is not wetlands. It's now going before a judge in an administrative law hearing, and they are both testifying on opposite sides. So this is really a fascinating story, because we now have the Deputy Secretary of DEP testifying that a project is going to enhance wetlands, and the DEP's expert on wetlands testifying on the opposite side saying, no, it's not. So it just shows that the absolute mess that the Department of Environmental Protection has got itself into by basically undermining one of their own experts and really hurting their own credibility.
Seems that the idea of the scientific method and the use of expert testimony is something that they rarely shy away from, evidently.
What they're trying to do, it appears, is that they're trying to intimidate their own employees not to come down on the side of environmental protection. Now, there's a story going around, which the DEP claims is untrue, but the story is that 100 of the DEP's professionals were told to clean out their desks, put all their materials and personal effects in their cars, come back to work, and at the end of the day, they would let them know which 25 were going to be let go. Now, DEP now says that's not a true story. However, people who work in the agency said it was. Well, this all indicates really what's going on now is just intimidation. Anybody who works for the Department of Environmental Protection that tries to do their job is going to be threatened. And so it's very difficult to have environmental protection when the people who run an agency are basically coming down so heavy-handedly against their own employees.
You know, one of the things that you mentioned, and I'm not sure all my audience actually caught a really crucial factor that you mentioned. This is a situation where they tried to replace lowlands that would typically be flooded or covered in water or have resting water with an upland area where water would not normally accumulate.
Right, and I don't know the exact specifics, but Florida has all different types of elevations, and you're right. They basically wanted to take land that would not ideally be suited as wetlands, destroy areas that were very good wetlands, and then claim that they had replaced it with areas that were of lesser quality. So that's really a serious problem because, of course, we have a limited number of wetlands in the state. There's only a finite number of acres that can be wetlands, and every time we get rid of these wetlands, we're causing more water to be pushed out to tide, we're causing less water to go into our aquifers, and we're increasing flooding on anybody who's already developed in other wetland areas that may be adjoining those wetlands.
Do you mean to suggest that water won't flow uphill when it's politically expedient?
It can be very expensive.
Oh, my friend. This is unfortunately not a unique situation. It seems that one of the things the Florida government doesn't really want is people who are effective in their jobs. There was a case where the people trying to protect us from the mortgage bandits got fired because they were doing their job too effectively. But let's stay focused on the world of the environment, which is your own focus, and let's talk about water quality. It seems that the state hasn't quite got its fill of telling the federal government, don't worry, we like our water really polluted. Could you talk about that excessive federal regulation that tries to keep our water safe despite the state's interests?
Well, there's a lot of very powerful interests that do not want to be monitored. Now, Florida originally had narrative standards, which were very ineffective. And narrative standards basically were, you basically made a subjective judgment about a water body, saying it was fishable, swimmable, or, you know, they had a number of different standards. But it was, there was no way to really monitor it because it was all somebody's judgment. It was subjective. Somebody could say, well, that looks fishable to me, and somebody else could say, well, it doesn't look, you know, I wouldn't want to eat the fish out of that water body because it's very polluted. So what the EPA, at the request of a number of environmental groups, including the Sierra Club, which went to court, filed a lawsuit, was done by Earth Justice on behalf of those organizations, asked the asked the Environmental Protection Agency to come into Florida and enforce the Clean Water Act. Now, the Clean Water Act requires that Florida meet certain standards. And what they decided in that lot, those environmental organizations won, was that the best way to enforce the Clean Water Act was to have standards that were numeric, so that there could be no debate on whether it was met or not, that you would just simply have a number, and you would either be above or below that threshold, and then based on whether you're above or below that threshold, you would be required to modify what's going on that's causing it to be at the polluted state it's in. Now, Florida has a huge number of very, very polluted water bodies because a great deal of Florida is canals. We basically got rid of our streams and rivers in much of Florida and replaced those with these large canals. And one of the things the state has wanted to do all along was not include canals as part of the standards. Now, your wildlife, when you take away their streams, their rivers, and you replace them with the canals, to them that becomes their where they live. They no longer have the natural stream they originally had, so now they're living in a canal. People continue to live alongside canals. They fish in canals. People periodically fall into canals. And if the water gets extremely polluted, those canals flow into the ocean, and you get very polluted ocean as well. So the, one of the big arguments has been, how are you going to treat all these various water bodies and what levels you will have? Now, the big agribusiness and utilities have wanted to not go forward with any kind of very strict standards, and so they've objected strenuously to the Environmental Protection Agency standards, and the Department of Environmental Protection, Florida's Department of Environmental Protection, basically has come up with its own program, and they are arguing that they should be allowed to create their standards, their numeric standards, and then monitor those standards. One of the difficulties, however, is that their approach to monitoring is much less efficient and effective. In other words, they would wait until water bodies are extremely degraded before they would begin to try to come up with a solution, whereas the EPA would suggest that if the water body is degraded, then you need to come up with a solution very quickly, and it should be returned to a more pristine, or if not pristine, at least a healthy state where you're not damaging the wildlife and the people who live around that water body.
Yeah, we've talked about those issues before.
I'm going to stop Mr. Martin right there. I've got Mr. Matthew Schwartz back of Florida Wildlands. Let me bring him back on and get his report from the West Coast, and then we'll play the concluding portion of Drew Martin. So here we go back with Mr. Matthew Schwartz, live from the West Coast. Matthew, so tell us about how goes it with the Florida Panther. Are they making some strides back?
Well, I made some strides because I found my way to a Starbucks.
Ah, there we go. Yes, you're coming in 5 by 5.
If you can't get a good signal at a Starbucks, the world is probably coming to an end. So here I am off Tamiami Trail. Right, we might break up again, though, because I do have a pretty much of a budget T-Mobile service, but it's a good price, but they don't have a lot of towers. So let's see how it works. Can you hear me okay right now?
5 by 5, my friend, 5 by 5. Go ahead.
Okay. So anyway, this is Southwest Florida. I'm in Estero, probably about 50 miles north of Naples. And 41 is kind of the main, I guess, 41 Tamiami Trail is the West Coast version of US 1. And a little west of here is I-75, and from there on, it's pretty much, it's a battle, because there's all kinds of wildlands out there. There's the Picayune Strand and the Fakahatchee and the Big Cypress and the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge, but there's also lots and lots of private land, and every time I come out here,
I'm always amazed at just how much more has gone in. I mean, if you come out here a year later and you look at a place that was once panther habitat, it's now some new subdivision. A lot of battles out here. Like I just said, there's the Picayune Strand, which is a state forest, and they've decided that that's a perfect place to put a reservoir. So they're basically plugging up the canals that have kind of kept it dry and good for panthers and putting in massive pump stations. It's all closed off now. You can't really see too much of what's going on in there right now. But essentially, they're turning it into what they turned a lot of the Everglades into, which is water conservation areas. So when you look at a map of southeast Florida, where we live, you see this big blocks of land in Weston Broward and Weston Palm Beach County, and it says the Everglades. But it's really not the Everglades. It's these water conservation areas. They're impoundments. And that's unfortunately what a lot of Everglades restoration is starting to look like it's going to be. These massive impoundments. And just this afternoon, I saw the essentially the impoundment water conservation area that they're turning the Picayune Strand State Forest into. Right across from the Strand, there's a little two-lane road called Everglades Boulevard. A handful of people live on it. In fact, when I was going over Everglades Boulevard to get into the Strand today, I see a guy on a horse and buggy going on the road. And the Department of Transportation wants to put a massive new I-75 interchange there to develop that area. I've talked before on this program about the Hendry County plant that's further to the east.
Sure.
And there's all kinds of stuff going on at any given time. You know, I call it, it's like doing this work is like playing whack-a-mole. It's just they keep popping up and you got to keep fighting it. We lost about a month ago. I guess the most significant battle we lost was about a month ago when the 11th Circuit Court, the Court of Appeals, decided that the Florida panther was not going to get critical habitat. And that was a big loss for us, for the panther, because what that means is that the panther itself is protected under the Endangered Species Act, but its habitat isn't. And it's not just the panther, and the panther is considered an umbrella species. So lots and lots of animals and plants, endangered animals live under that umbrella that protects the panther. And so right now, yeah, you can't shoot a panther, you can't throw garbage at a panther, but you could build a subdivision on its habitat or a golf course or a power plant. So it's made the work much, much harder. But the court also, you know, the court didn't rule that the Fish and Wildlife Service cannot designate critical habitat. All they basically said is the panther became endangered, listed as endangered under the Act in 1973. The 1978 amendment, which required critical habitat for any endangered species listed, only counts for animals that are listed after 1978. So sorry, panther, you missed out. But it doesn't mean that the Fish and Wildlife Service cannot do it if they choose to. So I think that's where we're going to have to put our pressure. That's where I think we've got to go. We've got to put pressure on the Fish and Wildlife Service, which is a branch of the Department of Interior, under well-known Ken Salazar, and that's directly under Obama. This is not something that Congress, you know, people say, the president's hands are tied. He's got to deal with a right-wing Republican-dominated House of Representatives. That's not true with regard to endangered species, with regard to parks. So Obama could wake up in the morning and say, you know what, I spoke to Sasha and Maya, and they want the panther to have critical habitat, and he could do it. So we're going to have to really put some pressure on him now that he's no longer candidate Obama and he doesn't really have any worries about ever getting reelected again, to start making some strong, hard choices about protecting wildlife like our state animal. We've got an ongoing lawsuit in the Big Cypress National Preserve that's trying to keep motor vehicles out of 130 miles of wilderness-eligible land, also major habitat for the Florida panther. All of these things are directly under the Department of Interior. And we need a good Department of Interior. Unfortunately, we haven't had one under Ken Salazar. And there's some people who are asking for Ken Salazar to be replaced in the second term in favor of a gentleman named Raul Grijalva, who's the ranking member of the House Natural Resources Committee. And that wouldn't be a bad idea.
He's a wonderful progressive. Absolutely. Wonderful progressive legislator.
You're familiar with him?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So, the Center for Biological Diversity put out a sign-on letter, which South Florida Wildlands did sign on to, asking, well, we didn't really ask for the firing of Ken Salazar. We just simply ask for, this is a good man to put in that position. And I think
Salazar can always find his way back to his seat in development and mineral mining, I guess.
Exactly. And that was what was so unfortunate when Obama made that choice early in his first term, because we knew what was coming. We knew that this was not a man who was going to take a strong stand in favor of the environment. I mean, my God, when he opened up the Chukchi Sea in Alaska, offshore oil drilling off the northwest coast of Alaska, one of the most remote places on Earth, and he gave leases out the shell. And that was a bad sign. You know, we've got that XL pipeline still hanging over Obama. He hasn't made a decision. And I should announce to people.
He's delayed for weeks now. He's delayed. Isn't that wonderful?
He's what?
I said he's delayed for weeks now.
Delayed. Yeah, delayed. But we're still waiting on the final determination. At any rate, I'm going
to
let
people. I was trying to make lemonade there for a second.
Yeah, it's hard because I'm not sure exactly what I'm hearing. It's still a little bit break up here. But on President's Day, people will be gathering in Washington. There'll be a massive demonstration there. I've spoken to Bill McKibben of 350.org, and he's hoping that rather than having local demonstrations around the country, he's hoping on President's Day that people will converge in Washington, D.C. for a massive demonstration protesting the we're calling for the basically not approving the XL pipeline. Everybody knows that that'll bring tar sands oil from Canada, from Alberta, down to the Gulf for oil refining. And that's one of the messiest, dirtiest projects on Earth. They basically, if you look at aerial views of Alberta, and they describe a piece of land the size of the state of Florida basically being strip mined for oil shale. Because they don't drill that stuff, they don't pump it out of the ground, they dig up the dirt, and they squeeze out the oil. And that's what they want to send down through that pipeline. And it'd be a great thing if people from Florida, I mean, have you talked to anybody about what happened on A1A recently? Anybody on your program talk about that yet, Rick?
No, what happened?
Well, what happened on A1A, and I haven't actually gotten back down there to see it, but friends of mine have been sending me pictures. So over Thanksgiving, a whole section of A1A became part of the Atlantic Ocean, because the waves were high, the seas were high, and it just kept pounding, and A1A and the seawall north of Sunrise Boulevard basically fell into the Atlantic, and A1A is now a two-lane road. No kidding.
Jeez, I'm surprised that wasn't all over commercial media.
Well, it was on, I guess it was on, I mean, the Sun Sentinel covered it. It should have been on more commercial media, because it really is a good look at what's coming. You know, when scientists, I keep telling people, look, when scientists predict an eclipse, nobody's surprised when the eclipse happens. When scientists are saying that pumping the amount of CO2 we're pumping into the atmosphere is going to change our planet's climate, and that climate starts to change, nobody should be surprised.
Well,
I read a report.
I understand up in New York now they're saying hurricanes, not just for Florida anymore.
Not just for Florida anymore, but, you know, with our 1 meter above sea level, Everglades National Park, and communities that are a little more than that above sea level, I mean, it could really happen. It's not just science fiction anymore. It's not speculation. It's too bad you're a radio program. We can't put some of those pictures of what A1A looks like these days on your show and take a look at it, because, in fact, I got something in the mail that there's going to be some kind of a community meeting, I think December 6th or something like that, on that topic.
Well, if you get a chance to go, give us a call back, Matthew, and let us know what happened, okay?
I will definitely give you a call, Rick. So we've got lots and lots of things going on. I wish I could have one comprehensive statement to say that would sum it all up and give you, leave your program on a good positive note. But
well, tell us how people can get in touch with you. That'll be a good thing. Tell them how they can help. Give them your email address or your web address, whichever you prefer, sir.
Okay. They can contact me by email. It's really easy. It's southfloridawild@yahoo.com. That's my email address. And we're getting a very active Facebook page, and that's where I post a lot of this new information, because it's really easy to post on Facebook. And that's just facebook.com/southfloridawild. Our web address is southfloridawild.com, or southfloridawild.org. And that's basically it. I'm Matt Schwartz. I'm trying to protect what's left of nature in South Florida. It's a tough job. If people want to be generous on the Christmas holidays, they can go to our Facebook page or our website and click on the donate button. We could always use some extra funds. We got lots of litigation coming up that costs money.
Thank you so much, Matt.
But people can stay in touch and keep fighting. Thanks, Rick. Thanks for the program.
Okay, and you take care, my friend. Call us when you got some more information, okay? Thank you.
Take care, man. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. That was Matthew Schwartz of Florida Wildlands. Now I've got Mr. Phil Compton of the Sierra Club. Phil, welcome, sir.
Good evening. It's great to be with you again.
Oh, it's our pleasure, sir, our pleasure. What's new with Sierra Club State of Florida, sir?
Well, I work from the Sierra Club State Headquarters, which is in downtown St. Petersburg, and we've been there for the last 12 years in a couple of different buildings. Tomorrow morning is a very exciting day for Sierra Club because tomorrow at 10:30 we have a press conference where we are cutting the ribbon and opening our new net zero energy building in downtown St. Petersburg. This is the first time that Sierra Club has ever done this. It's a really fantastic building that I'd like to take a minute and tell your listeners about.
Please do, sir.
We're not just walking the walk, but we're talking the talk. We're doing it here in St. Pete.
That's fantastic. So tell us, what does that actually mean, sir?
This is a building that's been built from the ground up. This is a building where we are plugged into the grid, but on the overall, we will be using, we'll be selling Progress Energy about as much electricity as we're buying back from them. So it's a wash. In other words, we are totally self-sustainable. We have solar panels on the roof. We have geothermal AC and a very efficient building. We're doing everything we can to reuse our resources in a very efficient way and really have little or no environmental impact as we do our job at Sierra Club of saving the planet. We figure, hey, we need to show the community, show the Tampa Bay business community how a small business office can be part of the solution to pollution by not creating any pollution, by not requiring any utility to burn more coal or natural gas or anything, any fossil fuel, in order for you to operate your business.
That's fantastic.
Thank you. Just to tell you about a few things, how do you get there? This is a LEED Platinum certified building.
First one
that's been built in St. Petersburg. And a lot of your listeners know what that means. St. Pete's been a green city for a long time, but this is the first LEED Platinum building that St. Pete's had. We have geothermal AC and heating. You put a pipe 250 feet into the ground, two pipes actually, and you borrow some of the water. You get down deep enough where the water's cold enough, so the heat differential actually is what drives your air conditioning. I can't explain it technically, but
that's
tomorrow
amazing.
Morning we're going to have a dozen experts from Bosch, the company that designed and installed this, there to explain to people. So we're having an open house. If you're in the Tampa Bay area, come to our office tomorrow at 1990 Central Avenue. If you've ever been in St. Petersburg, you're probably familiar with Haslam's Bookstore, an independent family-owned bookstore. It's been there since 1933. We're across the street from them on the other side of the corner of 20th and Central. So please come. We'll have an open house after the press conference until 2 o'clock in the afternoon tomorrow. And we're really looking forward to being a part of the business community there in what they call the Grand Central District. But there's a lot of different features that we want to show off to the community and show people this is how you can do this. The building itself is R40, double insulated windows, low E, double reflective tint. The building itself is concrete block that has foam filled, so you have this rigid foam insulation, and that provides a really high R value, and it's also very strong, very durable. We have photovoltaic panels on the roof and on the carport, so that's where our principal source of electricity. And we have an EV charging station that's open to the public that's using the solar power from our roof.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Phil, isn't it though?
You guys are setting a standard. Clearly, you are the best Oh, that's just so amazing. I'm sure that I hate to put it that way, but I'm sure every other environmental group in the state's going, boy, why didn't we think of that?
Well, and actually, we hope also, to tell you the truth, that our peers around the United States look at our example too and transform their Sierra Club offices into this. This is something that's being designed and built by guys at All Florida Management. They're also building some net zero energy use condos in North Pinellas and Dunedin, and they are really great. Our other tenants are a couple of design firms who share the rest of the building with Sierra Club. So we have two separate offices there. And it's just the kind of a place where, you know, we want to work in this type of sustainable environment. For the designers, their clients want to come there, you know, so it's a very attractive place for their clients to come and see that, you know, they're doing something that's very green and very cool. And plus, you know what? Why do you do all this stuff? You don't have a power bill, and you're not contributing to climate change. Our big speaker tomorrow is really, aside from our executive director, Michael Brune, the face of Sierra Club nationally, the national director of our Beyond Coal campaign, Marianne Hitt, who's coming down from West Virginia. In fact, she's already here. And she is going to talk about how, you know, most of our electricity comes from burning coal, right? And we know about what that's doing to our planet, what that's doing to our future.
Oh, my God.
How do we get away from that? Well, you can close down these power plants, but also you can reduce our demand for the electricity that comes from these power plants that burn coal. So we can tell the utilities, actually, well, we don't need as much of your electricity anymore. Maybe that old nasty coal-burning power plant is no longer necessary. Maybe you can use our example and do more solar power. Maybe other buildings, and certainly commercial buildings, you know, can do incorporate these type of features into their plans for building. You know, Florida is finally starting to build new houses and build new commercial buildings again. Let's do it right this time, and we want to show all of the state of Florida how you can do it and not have a power bill and really not cost that much more to build a building this way. So we're very excited about it, as you can tell. And I'm excited that I get to work there.
Oh, of course. Phil, this must have taken some time to plan. Was this in the works for 3 or 5 years, something like that?
It's been in the plans for a while. They've been working on it most of this year, but they've actually built it from scratch. So everything that's in there, all the, you know, the flooring is cork, the countertops are recycled concrete, the entire building has done everything we possibly can to have natural light come through. So we have our offices have a lot of light, and then windows from our office go through windows in the conference room in the middle of the building. So our conference room has natural light, even though it's on the interior part of the building. A lot of thinking.
Wow.
And it was really great for us, the staff, because we actually got to sit down with the builder and help design our office space so that it works for us and make it as sustainable as possible. You know, natural light. We don't have to turn on any lights, you know, most of the day, right? So it's a really wonderful place to be.
That's so fantastic. I mean, talk about leadership. That is just the kind of thing that you like to hear from any organization. And now you are walking the walk, buddy. That's fantastic. I almost hate to ask anything else that's going on, but what other plans does Sierra Club have for 2013 in the near future?
Well, real quickly, it's very exciting for us because we have actually added two new staff people. We've expanded our clean water program to North and Central Florida from our base in Southwest Florida and the southern part of the state. So we're opening a new office in Orlando right now with a new staff person, Macy Zander, who I hope will be on your show next year. And also we have a new Florida Panther program. We'll be opening an office in Naples after the first of the year with a new staff person, Alexis Meyer, who is a wildlife expert who was teaching at the University of Tampa. And it's very important that we protect our panther habitat. You know, a lot of people like the panther, but as you know, we've had 24 panther deaths already this year, 16 by vehicles. It was really, we've almost hit the record already this year. And we've lost a lot of critical panther habitat in the state. and it's a critical, very critical time for Panthers. We are known as the people who stand our ground, and when it comes to protecting Panthers, you got to stand your ground because they need a lot of ground to survive. They need the type of transportation corridors, you know, the type of pathways, so they don't get run over by cars, and we have to plan for that. And so Alexis Meyer is going to be in our Naples office that will be opening up the first year, working with the community and everybody who cares about the Florida Panther. So we're very excited about this new program, and it's funded by Floridians to protect Florida's Panther.
Oh, that's wonderful. I know it's a little early to ask this question, but I know you guys have got your ears to the ground. With the legislator coming up on its danger season in early 2013, have you heard about any legislation coming down the pike that we need to be alert to?
Oh, yeah. There are so many things that we have to work on in the legislature, and that could be a whole another show entirely. But so we really do want to talk to you about that. But just one thing, for instance, transportation corridors. We talked about,
sure,
you know, the need to protect the Panther. But instead of making Florida streets, which are the most dangerous streets in America for people, we're in danger too. Crossing the street, riding your bicycle, walking down the street, kids walking to school. It is more dangerous to be a pedestrian or ride a bicycle in Florida than any place else in America. Instead of making our streets safer, our state's focused on building a new toll road, the Heartland Parkway, through the middle of the state, which won't serve anybody's needs, won't relieve traffic congestion on the West Coast or the East Coast or anywhere in Florida. It will just open a wild and natural part of the state where panthers and people and a lot of other wildlife reside currently, open that up to more sprawl development. So that is something that we are really very much opposed to. We're opposed to any new transportation corridors or interchanges that are going to promote areas, development in areas that, you know, now farmland. Because when you turn farmland into suburban sprawl type of development, you actually lose tax dollars. That kind of development costs more in taxes from all of us who are already there in the county where this is taking place than it puts into the tax base. So it's a ripoff of everybody. Plus, it destroys a lot of what makes Florida a special place. And it uses up our agricultural land as well. We're losing our agricultural land. So Sierra Club is very much for preserving our green open spaces in this state that we all need.
Absolutely. You know, and I think you struck a very important note. Too many people who don't really understand the environmental movement think that environment and habitat stops when you get to Homo sapiens. And you struck the right note there. You reminded people that we are part of the environment, that we're part of that biota that we all want to protect and make sure has a good environment.
And again,
Phil, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And congratulations on opening up this clearly groundbreaking building. Your commitment to the environment and to treading softly on the earth shows, my friend. Congratulations.
Thank you. And if anyone who's listening is in the Tampa Bay area, come by tomorrow morning. Press conference at 10:30 and open house till 2, 1990 Central Avenue in downtown St. Pete.
Thanks again so much. Congratulations, Phil.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye. And we'll get to someone from your organization to talk about legislator agenda a little later. Thanks again. We'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Bye-bye. Okay, that was Phil Compton of the Sierra Club giving us the news about their groundbreaking new headquarters in St. Petersburg, establishing a platinum-level LEEDS building. LEEDS is that environmental standard that all buildings aspire to, and platinum level sounds like just the top, the very top. Clearly, they're establishing a new standard. So I want to thank you for joining us. Next week, a debate among candidates for the Florida Democratic Party. I hope you'll join us. Susan Smith will be leading the discussion, and the candidates for Florida Democratic Party offices across the state will be featured on next week's show. So tune in next week. And from Progressive News Network, myself and my colleague, co-producer Mickey Royce, I want to thank you. I want to remind you to listen to our colleagues, Gwen Holden Berry with her show Here Be Monsters, Brian Stetton and his show Progress Toward Democracy, Susan Nylon, The Nylon Report, Anita Stewart and her show, Wise Women. Thanks so much for tuning in. Hope you tune in next week for the debate among the candidates. Thanks again. Happy holidays to you one and all. This is Rick Spezak, News Director of the Progressive News Network. Thank you for tuning in. Good night, my friends. Remember, there is a better world coming. And you are the ones that are going to do it. Thanks again. Good night.